welcome to Focus on Business. I'm your host, Lee Strickland. On today's program, we are going to be talking about legal issues related to starting and running a business. Let's call it Legal 101. All too often, legal issues get put on the back burner because they are thought to be too expensive or too confusing. But by putting legal issues off, things can get pretty complicated and pretty expensive to fix. In fact, you could be putting your business and personal assets at risk if you don't take action. On today's show, our guest, James Forrest of the Forrest Firm, is going to aid us in understanding how startups and small businesses, well, businesses of any size, can manage legal costs more effectively, understand the legal issues, and protect you and your business from costly mistakes, up to and including litigation. So let me tell you a bit about James. He is the lead attorney and the founder of an innovative law firm called the Forrest Firm. It's headquartered in RTP. And while James has an extensive career, he began his career in Atlanta, Georgia, at one of the largest corporate law firms in the world. And in 2005, James came to this area and joined Moore and Van Allen. At the Forrest Firm, though, James works primarily on corporate business transactions and legal setup of a company. From everything from the normal day-to-day to mergers and acquisitions, anything that requires transaction. And James is really adept at helping his clients understand the problems and manage the costs of legal compliance and dealing with legal issues. So I want James to tell us in a little bit about the Forrest Firm, but let me give you kind of a profile of the Forrest Firm. They work with entrepreneurs, startups, mid-sized companies in the area and beyond the borders of North Carolina as needed. And they offer a range of services and have an ability to help you get into the details that are important for you to understand in a normal, everyday language type of thing. So while James and them provide very sophisticated, full-service legal counsel, they make it approachable and understandable for the business owner and their staff. It's important for our teams to understand the issues as much as it is for us, the business owners. And so he's able to deal with different industry issues, to customize things to the client's needs, and to set expectations properly for pricing, responsiveness, and the accessibility to his team. So James, thanks for being here today. And I want you to explain a bit more right now about the Forrest Firm and how your model works.
Sure. Thank you, Lee. It's a real privilege to be here. I appreciate you having me on the show. The Forrest Firm is different, for sure. Our competitors are larger law firms. And as you know, when you engage a big law firm, you are generally
getting a big bill?
Well, not all the time. I was at two very large law firms that I was some of the best lawyers in the world and some people that I like very much and care for very much. But the billable hour model is the basis of any big law firm. When you call law firm X, you're going to talk to a lawyer eventually and you're going to get a bill. You're going to ask them to do something and they're going to take that task and either give you advice then or they're going to take it back and deal with it behind the scenes. And you're going to get a bill 30 to 60 days later that in a way you're really not going to have the ability to quantify. And some of that's legitimate in that as a professional service provider, our inventory is our time. And so there are tasks that an entrepreneur will come to us with that we really don't know how long it's going to take, how much it's going to cost.
Or how complex the issue is going to be.
That's exactly right. But what we try to do to differentiate ourselves is to be very proactive with the client, to educate them on the front end about the legal spend that they're going to get into.
And how do you do that?
So let's take an example. So very frequently clients will come to me and say, I formed my company, I'm dealing with customers, I've got these various issues with customers, I'd like to have a template customer contract that I have with my clients that will keep me as bulletproof as possible as it relates to legal liabilities between me and my customers. I've done that probably 100 times at least in my career for clients, probably more than that. And so I'm very aware of how long that's going to take. Things like that, we're pretty aggressive on. We'll do those on a flat fee 9 times out of 10 just to give the client some pricing certainty. There are other tasks such as litigation or researching some sort of technical compliance issue.
Or negotiating a contract.
Absolutely. That there's so many variables that we can't control. We don't know what the facts are. We don't know how the other side's lawyers are going to interact with us. We don't know how the other side's business temperament is going to be. And so there's so many variables that it's hard to quantify. So in those situations, we will try to break down the complicated project into phases. So litigation, for example, will break it down into, the first step is usually a demand letter. If you're suing a customer that owes you money, the first step is writing them basically a nasty gram in the mail that says, you know, you need to pay us or we're going to sue you. That's not a huge project, so it's very quantifiable.
Right.
If they don't pay, you know, the next phase is, you know, filing a complaint, which can be fairly complicated. You've got to have an intimate understanding of the facts, and you've got to do possibly some legal research, know what court to file it in. And so even though that's a little bit more complicated, we'll take some risks there. We'll say, you know, once we get to understand the client and their needs, exactly what they're asking for, we'll at a minimum commit to a good faith estimate about what the fees are going to be, and sometimes even put it on a flat fee. And that gives the client, as the entrepreneur, the ability to make an educated decision related to their risk management spend. And I think that's the differentiator.
Well, and you also do a model of sort of a retainer, right, where you work a set amount every month for your client, and they get a set amount of hours or services that for that. So for a 6-month period, can you talk about that a little bit more?
Sure. You know, the impetus for my firm was really talking to clients and getting their feedback about what they liked and did not like about larger corporate law firms. And the first thing is obviously pricing is expensive. And I'm not here to bang on lawyers. You know, I'm expensive too. But again, kind of sliding that leverage from the lawyer side of the table, maybe at least to the middle, so the client has the ability to understand the spin that they're getting into. For larger clients, that know they're going to have a consistent legal spend every month. They're going to have HR issues. They're going to have litigation. They're going to have intellectual property issues. They're going to have contract negotiation or some myriad of those things. They know they're going to spend. They can look at their historical legal spend and know they're going to have a spend every month. And so for them, what we try to do is come up with some sort of period of time, whether it's 3 months, 6 months, a year, and basically flatline that legal bill, you know, so that it's predictable for Mr. or Mrs. CFO,
right,
so that they're not getting a bill they don't expect. And we'll provide a certain amount of hours for that. That leads to pricing certainty. They usually get a reduced hourly rate for that. And probably, to my surprise, quite frankly, over the last 3 years, and the client's surprise, one of the most positive consequences of that model is the client and the lawyer, we really deepen our relationship, because they're not only calling me when there's an emergency, when I have to call James because I don't want to call him because it's going to be expensive, so they don't call me, or they only call me in an emergency, to a model where they're calling me about everything because it's part of the budget.
Right.
There's nothing. We're trying to get away from this kind of fearful relationship where you only call your lawyer in the most inopportune situations.
Yeah, after much later than you would normally should have called the lawyer. Makes the bill much larger. Now, I'm interested with our listeners understanding how your business model works back to what we've been talking about, starting a business. James didn't start just another law firm. When he was out there, he was talking to the potential client to understand what it was the client needed, what were they expecting, what was missing, and then he built the firm that can provide the services under that model that fits that niche for the customer. And that's really important. We've talked about, don't build a company or a product and then go look for your customer. Find your customer and then find out what they want. And as James said, that leads to a much more positive relationship between you and your customers. So, James, from that description of your services, one of the things I want you to explain to us is the options for us starting a business and the pros and cons from a legal standpoint of what choices we have. And so let's just kind of start with the first one. Explain something to us about the sole proprietorship. That just means I'm by myself. I'm not doing anything other than creating a business card and maybe picking a name and going out in the world and doing business.
Sure. Yeah. So let's say you're going to start a cleaning business, Lee. So we're going to call it Lee's Cleaning Business, and it's just you. You haven't formed an LLC or a corporation or anything like that. The biggest risk for you there is that your personal assets are going to be at risk if you incur contractual legal liability. So, for instance, with your cleaning business, let's say that you have a vendor that does X for you. The vendor doesn't do it correctly. Let's say you have a subcontract where you send a certain portion of your cleaning services out to someone else. They don't do it correctly. They
They don't pay their employees. They didn't pay their payroll. Something
comes back to you.
Some of their staff may have stolen something from one of the sites, done damage or something like that.
You're going to have some contractual liability. In that situation, your personal assets are going to be at risk.
So what do you mean about personal assets? What's at risk for me?
So your bank account.
Your house.
Well, yeah, there's some issues there. If you're married, there might be some credit. I'm not up on my creditor law issues, but there are ways to insulate assets from creditors. But generally speaking, the price point for forming a company is so low these days that it's almost a no-brainer to form some sort of company, no matter what business you're in, to insulate your personal assets from risk.
So the next one, I go from being a sole proprietor, I'm running Lee's Cleaning Service, and I decide to bring you in. So now it's James and Lee's Cleaning Service. We don't set up another legal entity. We just become partners.
Right.
So what happens to that?
Sure. Let me back up a minute. Before we get into kind of what entity to form, I really want to take a minute to focus on, again, what the actual corporate shell protects you from. So, yes, we should form a company. But if we don't form a company, you're protected as it relates to contract liability, but you're not protected as it relates to tort liability. And I've talked to a lot of entrepreneurs that don't understand that distinction. So, let's go back to your cleaning. So let's say you're a cleaning service. Let's say you have an office, mm-hmm. a physical location where your employees come and report in. You're probably going to have a lease. You're probably going to have a lease with a landlord. And let's say you don't pay your rent. They're going to sue you for breach of contract. Now, more than likely, if you're a small business, they're going to require personal guarantee anyway. But let's say they don't have that.
We'll talk about that a little bit more later.
Then you're going to have personal liability if you haven't formed a company. If you have formed a company, your liability will be insulated as it relates to contractual liability. Tort liability is different. That's negligence or some sort of intentional tort.
Fraud
is a great example that often gets brought up in breach of contract situations because people want to make the argument that their liability should not be limited to the corporate entity because there was fraud involved. But negligence, so you run over somebody or you clean someone's house with bad chemicals and they die, any of those situations could be deemed negligence. And so in those situations, a company's not going to protect you. So I just want to make sure your listeners understand, everyone, you hear very frequently, form a company, form a company, form a company. I want to make sure they understand what forming a company will not do for you.
Right.
It's not a get out of jail free card for intentional torts or negligence.
Okay. So partnerships have the same liability to the two or three partners, over how many partners there are, as the sole proprietorship, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. So the general partnership is really a thing of the past. Limited liability companies have really displaced those simply because in a general partnership, all the partners have liabilities for the business, and we've talked about the reasons why that's bad. So in an LLC context or a corporation context, and those are really the two most popular choices these days, you've got the ability to kind of insulate yourself from those liabilities. And
so let's stick with partnership for a minute. So in a partnership, there's two of us. Your partner messes up and he has no money in the bank. He has no assets. And so the partner somebody sues us. And so because I have assets, my assets have to satisfy anything, because you can't get blood from a rock, right? So you have to realize who you're in business with, and that if you don't take the step to legally set up an LLC or an S-corp or a C-corp, which we're going to explain in a little bit, then you're on the hook for everything your partner does too. And simply by not taking that step, if two of you are doing business together, you are a partnership and not protected, correct?
That's correct. That's okay. Absolutely correct. By forming the LLC or the corporation, you're basically insulating yourself not only from personal liability for your own actions, but also the actions of your partners.
Okay,
well.
So when I think down the spectrum, I go sole proprietorship, I think partnership, and then I think, which is one of the newer entities, LLC.
Right.
So what is an LLC? What does it do for me?
Yeah, so both with LLCs and corporations, you get limited liability. One of the big differentiators for an LLC is that it's a pass-through tax vehicle, meaning that the gains and losses of the company pass through to the personal tax returns of the sole owner, or if there are multiple owners, to the multiple owners. And it's really the most the most new and the most common vehicle I see these days. Now, there's a big exception to that we'll talk about in a minute. But LLCs tend to be very flexible. The statute was created in a way to make a vehicle that was both had pass-through taxation, as opposed to a corporation that has double taxation, right? For every dollar that comes in from a corporation, you pay tax at a corporate level, and then upon distribution.
So let me talk about that a little bit. So what happens with a pass-through entity from an accounting or a tax side of the equation is that you set up the entity and you're taxed as a single person owning an LLC, just yourself. You're taxed as a sole proprietorship. If you have more than two people or more, you're going to be taxed as a partnership under the tax code. And that means that all the assets flow through to you on the books. So the profit, all of that kind of information flows through. Depreciation, donations, all that kind of stuff gets spread out into an informational tax return that gets filed. And then you get a K-1. And we're going to talk about this on the November 5th show, but I want to kind of give you a background that tells you how much of the tax liability, how much of the profit or how much of the loss is going to be on your personal return. And there's some complexities to determining how much of that you can take. And again, November 5th, we're going to dig into that. But what we have to understand is that there are other options. And as James gets into the S-Corp and the C-Corp formation, we'll come back and talk a little bit more detail about pass-through. But just know, whatever money the company earns ends up coming to your personal taxes, and you may have to pay self-employment taxes or plus income taxes under an LLC taxed as a sole proprietorship or a partnership. So roll on, James.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. That's great advice, Lee. People tend to gloss over the C corporation simply because of the double tax issue. You know, you hear that the dollar's taxed at the corporate level and then once distributed to shareholders is taxed again. People are often afraid of that. But I will tell you, you know, one reason to think about that if you're a company, probably the major reason, if you're going to take on any sort of a sophisticated investment. As Lee's cleaning company, you're probably not going to go out and get venture capital. You're probably going to...
I'm sure they'll want to come in and clean up, but no. So no, venture capital, private equity, those kind of things are not going to come into what I would consider a mom or pop service type of company, which Lee's cleaning service in our example would be. But if we were going to decide to take it into a franchise or a licensing model and get bigger, we would be going from an LLC to a C corp because we would need to take on investors in most cases, and we would also need that more sophisticated protection. So,
right, and those investors prefer that simply because they're familiar with it. They also aren't interested in passive income, as we just talked about. In an LLC context, if they're going to get taxed on income that may or may not be distributed out of the business, that's something they may not be interested in. The other thing about corporations, too, just to so that we don't gloss over it, C corporations, is that sometimes if you're not going to be taking money out, you're going to leave money in the company for long periods of time, it may be better to pay that double tax in that you're not going to take it out twice. You're only going to leave it in, and it's going to be taxed at probably a much lower corporate capital gains rate. And so that may make sense if you're going to leave money in over time. So if there's any, like, my basic advice is if there's any likelihood that you're going to bring on sophisticated investment at some point, angels or VC, corporations probably the way to go. The price point to form a corporation is not that much different than an LLC. The formalities required with a corporation are a touch higher, but we can talk about that some. They're not insurmountable. So
let me define a couple terms for the listeners. An angel investor is an individual investor who will bring in their money into a company that they either like the technology, the products or services that are being presented. They're a friend or a family member maybe that wanted to back an early stage startup. If we look around the Research Triangle Park and out in the Triad and different areas around the country, we have a lot of companies that seek angel investors. And they may start out as LLCs. And sometimes the angels will let you stay an LLC. But most are going to expect you to become, a grown-up company to accept investors and do a C-Corp. Right, James?
Sure. Yeah, I've seen that quite a bit. And, you know, for those of you that are leaning towards the LLC, let's say you're not in the category of looking at sophisticated investment at some point, kind of the next question becomes, do you have an S tax election or not? One of the things that I feel like people are generally confused on that I talk to is they consider an S corporation as a separate legal entity, which it's not. There's really only two choices from a legal entity perspective. It's an LLC or a corporation.
Both of which can elect what's called to be taxed as an S corporation, which means a subchapter S. And that's a form we file with the IRS, Form 2553. We set up our LLC, we set up our C corporation, and then we go tell the IRS, well, we want it to be taxed as a flow-through entity. And that means the money's going to come up on your personal returns, and you're not going to have double taxation in either entity.
That's correct, and that's beneficial. You know, one of the things that we certainly need to talk about as part of this process is with an LLC, every dollar that comes in the door is going to be taxed at a federal level, a state level, and you're also going to pay your
payroll taxes,
Social Security, and Medicare taxes. And so with an S-corporation, you can set up a salary for yourself, run it. You can run it yourself. You can run it through a payroll company. And as long as it's reasonable, so if you set your salary at a reasonable number, you can basically save on the Social Security and Medicare portions of those taxes by paying full taxes on your salary. But anything above and beyond that is really classified as a dividend that will allow you to save on those Social Security and Medicare taxes, which are about 15% these days.
15.4 and going up.
Right.
So when we think of how this works, and James is talking about, again, some of the financial aspects of it, what we're saying is if you want to set up and take a W-2 salary out, we have options under corporation and S-corporation taxation, and an LLC taxed as an S-corporation to set up that relationship rather than everything flowing through and being dollar for dollar, I have to pay self-employment taxes on it. When it comes through, you have a W-2 salary that you pay payroll taxes and income taxes on. And then you can take profits or distributions out of the company and get taxed only at an income tax rate. And so I work with my clients a lot of times on that, James, because we have to manage the tax burdens, and we like to keep as much of our money legally as we can. And as James said, a reasonable salary. I tell my clients, when you're starting out, if you take out 50-50 profits, a lot of times that will be fine. So you get 50% in your salary and 50% in the profits. As you get larger and more successful, like I start telling my clients, well, the minimum you're going to take out is whatever that year's maximum Social Security tax limit is. And that kind of gives the IRS to know that you're paying the maximum Social Security and other taxes. But that's something you have to work with your accountant on, and we're going to talk more about in the November 5th show on accounting for your business.
Sure. One thing I'll say about the S-corporation, just to make your listeners aware, is that different classes of ownership aren't allowed. So if you're going to have two different classes of shareholders, A and B, preferred, common, you know, any of those distinctions, voting, non-voting, that's not allowed with an S election. The other thing, too, is that there's a limitation on the number of shareholders that you can have.
And that's, what, 75?
I think it's 100.
100 now?
Okay.
It's been a while.
No non-resident aliens and no corporate entities. So all the members or shareholders of the company have to be
individuals.
Yep.
Right. Or an S-corp can own an S-corp, but not an LLC, is my understanding. Is that correct? We'll have to look that up and get back to it.
Yeah, that's right.
So let's talk about C-corporations in some detail and explain what that model is and what that, if there's more isolation, which I argue that for my clients there usually is, more separation when it's a C corporation than the LLCs, et cetera.
I think what you're probably alluding to there is the idea of corporate formalities. People that form C corporations and have sophisticated investment, different classes of stock, you know, they have sophisticated counsel. They're following proper corporate formalities, meaning that their books and records are in order. They have bylaws. They have a shareholders agreement. They have probably a stock option plan of some sort. Whereas in an LLC, you know, back to our example of some of the smaller businesses without investment may opt for that vehicle. One of the things that I advise clients on frequently is if they choose either route is that you really got to be attentive to those proper corporate formalities. Again, having your books and records in order, making sure that you're not commingling bank accounts. You don't want to be pulling money out of the corporate account to pay personal bills. You want to keep everything separate. Because the reason that makes a difference is because when you get sued, and the whole reason of forming the company, remember, was to insulate your personal assets
right.
from risk. So if you get sued, a creative plaintiff lawyer is going to argue, they're going to ask you to present your books and records and in your bank statements and these various things. And if they're not in order, and there's various pieces of that we probably don't have time to get into here, but if they're not in order, they're going to make the argument that they can, quote unquote, pierce the corporate veil and get to the personal assets that you elected to protect by forming the company in the first place.
Now, I know when I started my business, I started as a C corporation. I elected the S taxation and structure. And I did that for a number of reasons. Doing business in different states, as I do, I needed some consistency in understanding how each state was going to treat my entity. And LLC laws can vary state to state. At one time, some states didn't allow a one-person LLC to exist. And so by understanding how the legal entity is going to impact protecting your assets and how it's going to make your life easier in the long run, but you have to be diligent in doing things like your corporate reporting, your financials, that annual stuff that you need to do in the corporation to make sure that they can't pierce that corporate veil, as James was saying.
One example of this is minor, but I think it's important, is that in North Carolina, corporations are required to have an annual board meeting, and you can either do that, which most corporations do, if there's more than one person or party involved. Whereas an LLC, you don't. And so I don't advise that. You still need to have your meetings to, again, kind of make sure that your books and records are in order on the LLC side. That's just one example of they're just a bit more formal. It's not insurmountable, but you're going to have your traditional board of directors. You're going to have your traditional officers, whereas the nomenclature with an LLC is a little bit different and designed to be a little bit more flexible. And I think most of that is because the LLC statute is newer. You know, the corporation has been around for so long.
Right. Now, I know when we set up my S-Corp, we in our the C-Corporation and elected the S, we also took the step of putting it in the articles of organization and all the other documents, is that being a one-person company, I can simply file a letter board meeting on a certain date each year that summarizes the activities, the financials, and the forecasts for the business, and keep that in a standard corporate book that I keep off-site. So in the event something would happen, I have those records saying, here is the corporation and here I am.
Right. I have a number of clients that will ping me once a year, or I'll ping them, and you know they'll ask for the template, you know, unanimous written consent resolution, where they're basically documenting their once a year board meeting or manager's meeting. And usually that's good enough. I mean, this is not, you know, if you have your meeting or not, whether or not you're going to have your veil pierced or not. It's really just kind of one of the facts of, you know, you need to have your house in order in terms of your books and records.
And it's the books and records are something as a business. You need to have sound business records that are current and accurate, and that you're doing things right and making the business separate from you. Your decisions are informed decisions when you have those financials. And so what we're trying to say here is that the liability and the risk is probably going to be there with you, even if you set up a corporation, if you don't do things properly, if you don't tend to business. Also, we've talked about it on the banking show a few weeks ago with John Roten of Harrington Bank, that banks expect personal guarantees. Your landlord may expect personal guarantees because your business is going to have your credit history until it starts getting in its own. And it can be decades or, you know, before the business has a strong enough credit or presence that they're not going to ask for a personal guarantee.
Landlords typically have very sophisticated counsel. And they know that if they sign up a tenant LLC without a personal guarantee, that there's no guarantee there's going to be money in that LLC to get if the tenant defaults on the lease. And so unless you're willing to put up money or some sort of letter of credit or something like that, usually a personal guarantee is going to be required.
So we're going to take a break, and we're going to go to I Fought the Law and the Law Won. And I hope you enjoy that right now.
I needed money 'cause I had none. I fought the law.
The Ronald McDonald House of Durham is holding a fundraising breakfast on October 22nd at 7:30 a.m. at the Cotton Room in Durham. For more information, please visit www.ronaldhousedurham.org or call them at 919-286-9305. And if you're not in our listening area for the Durham Ronald McDonald House, our area has 7 other Ronald McDonald Houses, including one in Chapel Hill. And we would ask you to find the local Ronald McDonald House in your area, and please support Ronald McDonald Houses across the country. We'd also like to thank our underwriters, IWP Photography and Video, capturing the important moments of your life. They specialize in events, weddings, and live event paintings. For more information, visit IWP Photography's website at www.iwpphotography.com. We'd also like to thank Focus Resources. Get practical advice on how to start, fund, grow, and run your business. Focus Resources also specializes in government grants and contracts for early stage and established companies. For more information, visit them at www.focusresourcesinc.com. You are listening to Sonata in D for trumpets and strings. And you also listened to I Fought the Law and the Law Won by the Bobby Fuller Four. I hope you enjoyed the music. I try to theme it every week to go along with the show topic. And before the break, we were talking about legal entity types and our options for controlling the costs of our legal needs in the business. And James, I want to ask you really quick. We keep hearing ads for sites and services, things like LegalZoom.com. What makes the difference between that? When is it safe to use? When is it smart to use it? And when do you really think you have to talk to a lawyer?
Sure. Yeah. First of all, I would say that I certainly appreciate the fact about LegalZoom that they're trying to keep costs down. I mean, that's certainly one of our firm core values too. I would appeal to your listeners' reasonableness in that with anything, it's usually not a race to the bottom in terms of pricing because you've got to consider pricing and quality. I mean, it's a cost-benefit analysis with everything that you buy. You know, whether you go to buy any sort of product for your home or some sort of service, it's not simply a function of pricing. That's certainly a variable and a large one, but it's also pricing balanced with quality. And so with LegalZoom, I mean, it's very clear that you're not getting a lawyer. You're really getting forms from a template, and those forms have been used over the years, and there's certain things that you can probably accomplish that way, but I certainly wouldn't recommend it. Quite frankly, the lawyers that I know practicing here locally, the price point for forming companies has come down quite a bit, and LegalZoom is part of that. For not much more than what you would pay LegalZoom, you can actually get a real live local lawyer talk to you about your decisions. And one of the things that you're not going to get with LegalZoom is someone to walk you through the differences in the entities that we just discussed. You're not going to get someone to walk you through, you know, how to choose your name and make sure you're not stepping on someone else's shoes with your name. Because the worst thing that can happen is you form a company and, you know, spend a bunch of time and money and energy focusing on a brand, and then you figure out that someone else has already got some sort of piece of that mark and you got to change course. So
right.
You're just not going to get any of that live dynamic help as opposed to LegalZoom. So on one hand, I applaud the effort to bring the price point down, but there's a middle ground where the pricing can be fair to the client and reasonable and predictable, but not without the live services of the lawyer.
Well, like when we hear the LegalZoom commercials, we always hear the little warning that this is not legal services from the standpoint of getting advice, but you're managing your own activity that's there, so you don't have a lawyer managing it.
Right.
So you brought up just now the name. So how do we know if the name is available and what may have been attached to that name conceptually?
Sure. No matter how small your business may be, if you form a company with a name that has been used by someone else, or they have the rights to use that name, you can get into some pretty deep trouble pretty quickly. So a couple pieces of practical advice. One thing that you can do is you can go to the North Carolina Secretary of State's website, punch in your desired name, and see if anyone's close to it or anyone has it already. The Secretary of State's not going to let you form a company that has the identical name of a company that's already been formed, but I've seen some very close ones get through. So,
well, I know when I was forming mine, I wanted Focus Resources Incorporated, and there was a Focus Resources LLC, and they wouldn't let me put an S on resource because of that. And so I ended up filing a doing business as name as Focus Resources. And so that challenge in the Secretary of State's office, it's not 100% reliable either, because about, I'm going to say 4 years ago, they allowed someone else to form the name Focus Resources Incorporated in Charlotte. And so that became a legal issue for me. And fortunately, I had gone through the trademark process and had carved out the name and what it stood for here in the state and across the country. But that's something everyone has to consider, right?
Right, absolutely. Just because they let you through at the Secretary of State level, don't assume that that's a clean bill of health from trademark. Trademark is totally something totally different. Trademark is, for your listeners that may not know, is, you know, having a federal registration for a mark, a logo of words, or a combination thereof that distinguishes your brand from other people in a particular industry. And if you form a company and use a name or a slogan that someone else already has trademarked, even if the Secretary of State lets you through the door, that you're probably going to get a cease and desist letter down the road, either asking you to stop using it or, even worse, asking you to pay them money for any revenue that you've generated based on the brand name that they've built. One other practical thing you can do on the front end is go to USPTO.gov, the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, and you can look and see search through federal filings there. You know, depending on how close your desired name is to something that's already out there, we have lawyers that practice with my firm that can guide you through that process pretty quickly, can help you look through and say what your risk is. You know, it's not going to be with absolute certainty, but they can say, we think it's 80-20, you'll be fine, or 50-50. And if it's 50-50, maybe you go to a different name. It really depends on the desire, how much you desire that name.
Right. So we're going to talk about naming on next week's show and domain names and all of those kind of things. So I'm going to kind of leave the naming topic and say we've kind of covered that to the extent we went to this week, because I really want to get into the next section. And this is where a lot of my clients have issues, is the contractual relationships they establish with employees, independent contractors, vendors, and customers. And so, James, just kind of walk us through that. Let's do employees first, because I don't want to dig too deeply into that. We've got someone coming in the future, but kind of frame it for us. What do we need to know about employment agreements, and what can we put in there and what can't we?
Let me first talk conceptually about the idea of putting a template in place, because I find myself having that conversation frequently with entrepreneurs. Most of the people that I work with, you know, or early stage companies, they will, you know,
borrow a template.
That's right. They'll have a customer, or they'll have a particular vendor, and they'll look on the internet and find a form and throw it together, and they'll read it, and it looks fine, and they'll sign it, and that's okay. So this is the same analysis as forming a company. The price point to have a template contract drawn up for you is not all that high. I mean, it's 2 or 3 hours worth of work, basically. It's not insurmountable.
It's an investment.
Absolutely. And then I don't think people are afraid of the price necessarily. I think it's more of ignorance about the terms they may be missing by not utilizing
that. They don't know what they don't know.
That's exactly right. So, you know, in the employment context, some of the key concepts that you're going to find are confidentiality. You want your workers to keep all of your information confidential.
Non-competes.
Restrictive covenants, which include non-competes, non-solicitations. You don't want your employees competing with you post-employment. You don't want them soliciting your customers or vendors or employees. Another big rock for employment agreements are what I call work-for-hire provisions, which I'm not an intellectual property lawyer. I'm a transactional lawyer, but I've sat in enough meetings to understand that that's important, and that you want to make sure that all the intellectual property that's generated by your employees actually belongs to the company, can be sold with the company, and some of those provisions can be really important.
Well, and that's one of the critical ones around in this area with the technology companies that we have in the area, that they make clear that is in place. And for those people who work a day job and they start a business while they still have a day job, you need to be clear if you're going to practice what your area of expertise in that business that you're starting, where the lines are with your employer as to what do they get and how far does that reach, and how long do you have to be aware of? It may be 2 years, it may be 3 years. Every state is a little bit different in my experience working with clients. But make sure you understand that work for hire agreement. You can't say everything they think about 24 hours a day is yours. It's usually in the area of expertise they're practicing for you. But you can't say work for hire for, let's say, a financial person who knows how to do forecasting. You're not going to have every forecasting model I ever make covered under that work for hire agreement. There's a reasonableness to it, and it should be called out fairly specifically, in my experience, in your employment agreement or your independent contractor agreements that are also a form of work for hire, the details of that.
Sure. Let's talk about customer contracts.
Great.
That's something that everybody has.
We hope.
Exactly. If you've got a customer, you know, maybe you're doing business on a PO basis or, you know, an engagement letter, and that's fine. However, I think the minimal investment required to get a template customer contract in place is well worth the time. A couple things there. Let's talk substantively about some of the issues that are important to have in your customer contract. And then two, I want to touch on like the presentation of the contract and the way it looks on a sheet of paper and why that's important. Substantively, you know, one of the biggest things that you can have in one of these contracts is what I would call a limitation or disclaimer of warranties. You want to make very clear what you're providing to your customer, what the product is, what it will do, or what the service is, and what you're guaranteeing related to that product or service, and be as narrow as possible, and then disclaim everything else, any implied warranties under the law or implied warranties of merchantability. You just basically want to narrow what you're agreeing to provide them, because the broader it is, or if it's left open, there's more likelihood that you're going to be sued for breach of contract by failing to provide that product or service in a way,
in that way,
that meets their expectation. Right. So the more you can narrow that, the better. Also very important is what I would call a limitation of liability provision. These are usually in all capital letters in a contract, and it basically says, you know, even if I really screw this up, you know, you as the customer can't come back and sue me for more than X. And often you'll see the total fees paid. So if you sell a widget for $5,000 to somebody and they want to sue you, they can't come back and sue you for more than $5,000. This is really important when you're talking about litigation with your customers, which hopefully you never have, but when you do, and if you do, if you have this provision, it's going to probably save you a lot of money, because you're basically decreasing the variability of the amount of fees that can be won here. And so if they can only win $5,000, they're not going to go out and pay $10,000 to a lawyer,
right,
try to go get $5,000.
The cost benefit's not there unless you just really tick them off.
That's exactly right, and they got a point to prove. So that provision probably in and of itself is probably the most important in a customer contract provision,
okay,
that most people don't know about.
Let's think about vendor contracts, because we all have vendors in one shape or form.
Sure. So it's really the opposite analysis. You want, in terms of the warranty, you want them to give you as broad a warranty as possible. So whatever product or service they're delivering to your company, you want it to be very broad. An example would be, you know, we'll provide this product and we will make sure that it's performing strictly in accordance with functional specs for X period of time after the contract.
And we warrant parts and materials, but not labor, that kind of thing. So
that's right.
Just like when we buy our refrigerators or our cars, there are certain things that are not covered, and we need to understand those. And what we want, everything covered for the whole time we have the product, the life of the product. But that's not what we're going to see typically coming from our vendors giving us contracts.
That's correct. And with a services provider, you want language like, you know, they'll provide their best efforts to provide. And you just want to be as specific as possible at what you think you're getting. Because if you think you're getting X and they deliver Y, if that's not documented, you really have no recourse. And so it's just very important to be very specific about what deliverables you think that you're getting.
Well, when we think about that, so frequently we think we've said one thing and they've agreed. So how do we make sure that we're speaking the same language when we're writing that? I frequently see my clients, because they don't have a template or they don't want to spend the money for legal services, they will let the other party that they're hiring maybe provide the templates. And I try to tell them, anytime you get something from another entity, it's going to be written to their favor. And so that's something that your client may still opt to do, but they need to come to you to read that to understand it, correct?
Sure. I mean, that ties back into why I have a template. I mean, if you have a template, it's going to be favorable to you. It's going to allow you to lead the conversation. Your customer or vendor may not sign your form. You may not have enough leverage in the marketplace. I have clients that have really hot technology that they can demand their form be signed because the customer wants it. They're the only person that has it, has the patent
right
on it. So they're locked in. They don't have alternatives. the converse situation is, you know, you don't have any leverage. You're one of a million vendors they could use, and so they may not opt to sign your form. But when you do get a form from across the table that you're not familiar with,
read it.
And if you hire a lawyer, you're going to pay somebody as much as you would pay to develop your template in the first place to just do review one of these. So if you're reacting to different pieces of paper that come across from 10 different vendors, you're spending way more money than you need to if you've got the leverage to get your template to be the driving document.
Right, so the person that usually presents the document has the lead in the conversation. And so it also is a kind of a check mark for a lot of businesses to know how well developed the business is and how capable they are to be in business if you have your own forms, your own documents, and you have a better business understanding of what's going on and what you expect from your vendors and those kind of things. So one of the credibility type things that we've been talking about in other shows is investing in key documents, the templates for your contractors, your vendors, employment agreements, and understanding the things you need to be careful with and you don't give on and things that you can be flexible on. Right, James?
That's exactly right. I mean, I have clients that I've worked with for years that we've been dealing with their templates for years, and so their need for me goes way down because we've been through what happens when someone asks for, you know, a different governing law or a different warranty. We know kind of where our fallback positions are.
Tell them what a governing law is.
So there's a provision in most contracts that says that, you know, a lot of times you're dealing with companies that are maybe a different states, and so there's a question of whose state's laws apply. And many states are similar, but you've got some outliers, Louisiana, California, and so that are drastically different than kind of the more traditional Delaware-based corporate law. And so a governing law provision just basically says this contract will be governed by X law. Now, if it's one of the traditional states, I don't get too bent out of shape about that. What's more important in a contract, any contract, is what I would call the forum provision, which is where we're going to fight about things if we get into a fight. So do I have to come to you to sue you? Do you have to come to me to sue me? Do we agree to some neutral ground? And how do we make that dispute? Is it litigation, arbitration, mediation? You know, there's lots of things there to talk about.
Well, and when we take into consideration that if we have to fly to New York every time to fight with a customer and take it to court, that means you're going to have legal expenses, you're going to have travel expenses. You have a lot more expense to fight this in another state than if you set it up in the state in which you're operating to have everyone come to you to deal with it. But I kind of want to touch on this really quickly, and it's a surprise question because it just came to me. When we're doing business and we set up our corporate entities and stuff, we set up in a particular state. Mm-hmm. And then when we go into another state, we're a foreign entity doing that. And we should, right, get our business set up to do business in those states and recognized in those states as a registered foreign entity doing business with their Secretary of State's office.
Yeah, right. One of the things we glossed over with the formation process is what state to form in. And we mostly deal with North Carolina-based entrepreneurs. Most of our clients form in North Carolina, which is generally okay. North Carolina is very similar to Delaware, which is the state you hear most often talked about in terms of the popular state of formation. The laws there are old. They're robust.
Established.
That's exactly right. And so North Carolina is a great place to be incorporated. Absolutely. If you're doing business in another state, North Carolina has a statute that says if you're not formed in North Carolina and you're doing business here, then you've got to file a certificate of authority here in North Carolina. It's usually a small payment. You fill in your form and you're authorized. But you won't, in most states, you won't be allowed to file a suit there if you're
not registered.
That's exactly right. So you should do some analysis about, and there's some resources out there about what constitutes doing business in a state.
You know, each state tends to have a different, what's called nexus point. Some states it's how many days a year you're in there doing business. Some states it's simply showing up at a trade show and just, you know, dispersing your literature and marketing your business in that state. A couple states, all you have to do is send in a piece of marketing material as a mail item and you're doing business in their state. So that's something to think about and talk about in deciding where and how you're operating. And again, having a conversation, a relationship with an attorney early on to help you identify that, and also with an accountant, because with each establishing of your nexus in a state, there are going to also be financial and tax issues that you have to set up and address too for that. So we've got time for one more quick topic. And so let's jump in a little bit into intellectual property, James. Can you tell us what patents and trademarks, service marks, and copyrights are? and just kind of give us some background as to why we're interested in protecting our intellectual property.
Sure. Let's start with formation issues, because that's where we've been most of today. When you decide to form your company, you're going to go through the name selection process. Once you've gotten clearance, you filed with the Secretary of State, you're going to be operating under a name, probably a certain logo, slogan perhaps, that you're going to be using in the marketplace and building brand value around that. You can file for a federal trademark. I'm not sure what the price range is these days. I think it's $1,500 to $2,000 or so.
To get you started.
To get your trademark for one particular class. There's different classes you can file in.
So a class is how many different areas you want to practice that intellectual property in. So like for Focus Resources, I got it in something like 5 classes. And so that added cost for each class I filed. Right?
Yeah, that's right. I think it's about $300 per class. So if you're, most companies are operating in a class or two. And so the more classes you have, the more expansive your brand rights are. And what that trademark gets you is the right to prevent anyone else from entering into that space using anything that would be, quote unquote, confusingly similar to the consumer. So I can't go out and start a soda company and call it Coke, because I'm basically piggybacking off the brand that Coke has built over the last 100 plus years.
Yeah.
And so that's fairly low price point, fairly important to give you kind of put your flag in the ground from a nationwide perspective. I was here first. No one else can use this. Now, if you're going to be a local business, you know, it may not be as important, but it can still be worth it considering the fairly low price point, and that you're, if you want to expand in the future, if you want to franchise your restaurant after it grows, you've already kind of built that value.
Yeah,
there.
You've put the stick in the sand that says, here it is and it's mine.
Patents are a little bit bigger deal, usually a higher price point, probably $5,000 to $10,000. My IP folks are going
to start
kill me
to start
for quoting prices, but that's just kind of the way I think about it. There, it's a higher price point. You're basically protecting an idea, a process, or a design that's unique. And by getting a patent, you can prevent anyone else from commercializing your idea. Kind of gives you a built-in monopoly for a certain period of time. I think it's 20 years. And so it's something that's very important to think about, can be very, very valuable. One thing that I will say to smaller companies I think is important is you can file for a provisional patent, which is a much lower price point and kind of saves your date, so to speak. So you file your provisional patent, you preserve your place in line in terms of who was first, and then you get, I think, a year to go back and file the full patent application.
And so just this year, patent laws changed a bit. And so we used to be, as a country, first to file. Or first to invent, now we're first to file. Sorry, I need to say that correctly. So provisional patent has to substantially contain all the information that would be in your formal patent application, and it gives you 365 days to get that formal patent in order to claim that date. Some of my clients have made the mistake of thinking, well, if they just keep filing a provisional patent, their original date was good. It's only for that period. So if you don't file the formal patent within that 365 days, then you're not holding your filing date. And so you need to be aware of that. So one more quick thing, James. So what can you tell us in just a couple of minutes?
Oh, just
pick your topic.
Yeah, one of the things that I think is important, I mean, obviously, I think it's important to have a good lawyer and good counsel around you. It's also equally important to have good financial folks, bankers, insurance agents, and people that can work together. A lot of these questions that you're going to run into are joint analysis. It's not just one service provider's area of expertise. I mean, this whole choice of entity and taxation, that's a joint lawyer
business operation, yeah,
thing. And so having a team around you is vitally important. And I would also encourage you not to go out and try to find that all on your own. Find one or two people that you really like and you trust, and then ask them for people they trust. And that's a really good way to build out a team.
Well, most service providers get comfortable because they see each other and they know what each person does, and we experience broad ranges of different attorneys, accountants. And so we're out there and we kind of know who will fit with our client when we come in. And so usually you get one great service provider and they'll know several great service providers that you need. So insurance is one thing that impacts with our expertise, with what type of legal entity. Our accounting is impacted, our human resources, our hiring, our payroll. Everything comes together to understand that it has a business implication, it has an accounting implication, and it has a legal implication. And I want to thank James for being here on the show today to explain some of those legal implications. And James is with the Forest Firm in Durham, RTP, and you can look them up on their website, www.forestfirm.com. Correct, James?
Correct. Two R's. Thank you very much for having me, Lee. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, everyone, and we'll talk to you next week.